Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 108, where Sam, Greta, and Tom are discussing Irving Goffman's book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, originally published in 1956 and revised by Anchor Books in 1959. In part two, we examine the literature streams that followed this book, such as impression management and symbolic interactionism, while also considering how well Goffman's framework has withstood the considerable changes in societies since publication. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. In part one, we concluded with a great story about a misunderstanding or a misreading of the situation based on how someone was dressed. It reminded me of the early days of computing. And, you know, we're talking about how society is dynamic and changing and how it's been changing a lot recently. I think about how it has been continuously changing at a rapid pace in ways that people don't expect. And we maybe sometimes forget how much it has changed over time. Probably Google this photograph, but it was one that was taken of the Microsoft team. Bill Gates and that original founding team. In the early 80s, of course, corporate life, you know, there was a corporate uniform, if you will, where people were, men were short-haired, kept their hair short, were clean-shaven, dressed in suits and ties and all of that sort of thing. And then here is this picture of the Microsoft team where everybody is like long hair. Look, they were not dressed in suits. I think maybe a couple of them had jackets on or whatever, but they really did not match the corporate model whatsoever. And people weren't talking about how Microsoft was doing such wonderful things to bring computing to everyday life and all that sort of thing. They were talking about what a bunch of awful looking, I can't remember the specific terms. I'm sure I shouldn't repeat them here, but it was treated as a total shock to the system. And think about the different ways people present themselves and how the conflicts occurred over time. As we informalized in some areas, in other ways, we also became much more formal or hyper-formal in terms of dress, in terms of how we carry ourselves. And so there's always been these tensions of subcultures that form or go away all throughout time. It just so happens that right now, perhaps we're at a particular inflection point coming out of the pandemic as far as, okay, what are we? Are we different rules that we're not accustomed to regarding how we interact with each other because we do so much more remote now? And the remoteness during the pandemic brought us into a whole degree of informality and distance communication. Whereas we're also been, and I think we've mentioned in a couple of recent episodes, how the old formal ways or the old ways of going back into the office have been reasserting themselves in interesting ways. And so there is perhaps a lot more of this conflict that's going on as we try to figure out what does it mean to interact with each other nowadays. Also, especially with social media, where it is that much harder to be backstage or the backstage coordination almost has to be really tight because you get attacked for just about anything you say or do. And so that kind of creates a hunkering down culture, a risk-averse culture.
And I think, I mean, we've mentioned social media a bit, and we've also mentioned these kind of new ways of organizing that, you know, demand that you present yourself in a certain way in any situation, right? So we don't have this kind of hierarchical front stage, backstage distinction anymore. But I think it also has to do with just how we've modified the idea of the roles that we should be playing, even at work and, you know, what before would be considered formal situations. You know, this whole idea of like bringing yourself to work and being authentic and loving what you do. And I think that also contributes to this fading of the front and the backstage, right? So you're supposed to be your most authentic self, even when you're at work. So this idea of people kind of had this notion of, you know, you're at work, you dress in a certain way, you have a fixed schedule, you know, when you're out of work, and so you're, you know, back to the backstage. Whereas now, you know, you're supposed to be available all the time and you're supposed to be yourself when you are at work. And so I think that also creates, I don't know, perhaps more challenges for people. I think we're seeing that in some studies, but also for organizations, right? You know, I keep thinking about Kat Turka's book, this modern high-tech organization where, because people also expect, you know, the leaders of the organization to be very transparent about what they're doing and why they do the things they do. So you also have this, the limits of the front and the backstage also for people that are in leadership or power positions, where we want to see what they're, you know, what they're discussing, how they're making decisions, why they're making those decisions, and everything should be kind of more transparent and participatory. And so I think that creates also new challenges for organizations.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we could even broaden that up to societies, for whom is it very nice that everything is so predictable. Of course, this is just one lens. Let's start there. Like, you know, we had an episode where we discussed Garrett Morgan's book, Images of Organizations, where every lens is like a pair of glasses you put on, and then everything looks as if it fits the glasses. So some are pink, other ones are blue. So we have one pair of glasses here, Goffman's book, where we use the metaphor of a stage to look at society. And there is usefulness and there is also a trickiness. And I think for people, it is very useful to think like that and to use that pair of glasses and to operate in such a society. For instance, people that suffer from autism, people that suffer from social anxiety, if you know how things go, it might be less anxious to go. So what spaces in society do we have when everything is improvised on the spot all the time and we have to be our full self? And do I actually want to share my full self everywhere? Am I comfortable with that? And I think that there is definitely a cultural element there that is absent in the book. Not only thinking about organizational culture, where we also had an episode on, but also national cultures, where perhaps in some societies there is a greater separation between front and backstage, and where perhaps the backstage doesn't matter at all, it's all about the front stage. And in other societies where perhaps that separation is very strange to them because it's not there.
Well, to bring in images and organizations even further, we're perhaps reading Goffman as using a mechanical style metaphor by which front stage and backstage are physically separated. There is a space that is separate, of which activities of different types occur. I believe, you know, why I kind of think of us being at an inflection point right now is because we may be rearranging our front and back stages. And we haven't figured out how best to do that yet. So we're not thinking of it in terms of physical space in the way as before, but perhaps different slices of activity. There's no question that those who are under tremendous, you know, continuous monitoring or under a microscope, however you put it, are finding new and interesting ways of shielding themselves from it and making room for themselves to continue this shaping work. It's just that it may not be in a room. It may be in a virtual space. It may be something that's done like in a matter of the seconds in transition between one performance and another performance. And then the way in which teams learn how to cooperate and do that backstage work instantaneously on a very, very short amount of time, as opposed to something that may be a bit more deliberate, a bit more extensive, like it was shown in Goffman's Crofter example. What may not have yet totally sorted out yet is what what the new rules of the game are, which is why people are under a little bit more stress. The post-pandemic era is still upon us. We're still seeing how things are changing in the course of simultaneously return, some segments returning to the old ways-ish, and then this other segments that are somewhat in a new normal where they are demanding or they're signaling that we like the way things were, and we're trying to build a new way of life, make greater choices about the way in which we meld our work and our personal lives, the way that the old office environment did not ever allow. And then, of course, you have the other economic factors that are playing in that. Who's becoming victimized by this move to remote work, who were dependent upon, the coffee shops, all of these other businesses that were near office locations, who are now having to redefine themselves based on what everybody else is doing. You know, with more remote work, there's fewer customers coming in, things like that. It certainly feels dynamic right now because the rules of the game are still, the rules of the new game are still being shaped. They're still being written, and we don't necessarily know or can't at this point predict how it really is going to turn out.
Yeah, I really like the point you make. And I think I was going to disagree with your initial kind of statement that we're understanding front and backstage as these kind of like very physical spaces. But I think, you know, how you develop your reflection kind of supports why I was going to contradict you with that statement, because Goffman does says, right, there's a tendency for a region, citing here, to become identified as a front region or back region of a performance in which it is regularly associated. Still, there are many regions which function at one time and in one sense as a front region, and at another time and in another sense as a back region. So I think, you know, you've gave beautiful examples of how precisely we're at a time where these front and backstage are kind of being redefined. And I think the reason why I think Goffman's book is still very relevant, and I still, you know, I teach it now to my students of public policy in the organization theory class, is, you know, to understand and appreciate the effort it takes to give a coherent meaning to a situation, right? And Goffman talks throughout the book about the importance of coherence between a performance and the setting, and the, you know, the front and the, I can't remember how he called, like, the personal front, or the you know, the characteristics of how we dress and what we look like, and the importance of all of these being coherent so that you can have social order. And I think for me, that really explains some of the challenges that organizations and people are facing now, because you are seeing a shift of, you know, what gets defined as front and backstage. So then suddenly you need to not only maintain that coherence at certain moments of your day or in certain spaces in your day, but it's, you know, it's all the time. You need to be kind of guarding that coherence. Yeah.
And perhaps that's also a criticism to bring yourself to work. You know, I think that was like some sort of management fashion that's already got out of date pretty quickly. Thinking like, you know, who benefits from doing that and who doesn't? I think it was around the Me Too movement. But when you're a transgender, of course you have to be able to bring your full self to work. But one day it might be one expression of yourself, and the other way it might be the other. And maybe there might be a day that you don't want to bring yourself to work and just want to put on your uniform and go. And thinking about people that are survivors of massive trauma going back to work, they might not want to bring their full self to work, and they're really glad that they can leave it in the home, put on the uniform, and do their work, because that's an escape from dealing with that. Those are conversations where also the functionality of being able to take on a role might be good for a person. Of course, there is a lot of argument made that, you know, there's a lot of determinism in this book, a lot of assumptions about people of color, about gender, also a lack of consideration how social structures have an impact on how people behave, what are the ways to behave that are eligible for certain people, the lack of empirical study. But there is also an argument to be made to take on this lens, to look at society like that, and to sometimes take on a role is effective, is efficient, is helpful.
I'll agree. And I know that the characterizations In particular, some of the early parts of the book that talk about what women do to take on the role of somebody looking for a relationship, for example. It was a book of its time, but I did appreciate that although as bothersome as some of the examples were, at least what he avoided was casting judgment as the saying that this was in some way good or bad, or that certain definitions of settings were good or bad. They just simply were, and we reported as it is. And therefore, we're left now with the question of what becomes of the new roles? What should we consider in terms of what's acceptable for redefining roles if the society has changed in its values and it no longer adheres to or accepts some of the characteristics or the ways that people were characterized before? There's a lot of work to be done. Like when we say we make a lot of mistakes, part of that is just our learning about, well, what is going to be the new accepted way of doing things, or the accepted way of talking with people who you would have talked with differently before. But just for example, with the pronouns, the discourse on pronouns is a way of trying to get us beyond characterizing people according to gender, right? There's still kind of a feeling out. And so the performances in which a lot of people are putting out in terms of trying to be inclusive, use more inclusive language, etc. Once we've figured that out, of course, it'll be easy because then everybody will know what the rules are. But right now, it's still kind of unclear in the minds of some people. You can make mistakes and you'll be hit. And so it's just a signal of some of the uncertainty and some of the inability, for example, for us to be able to do some of this backstage work, because when we make a mistake in the front stage, it becomes very, very evident. It provokes a reaction, and then it actually disrupts, I think, some of the emergence of what ultimately will be the eventual right answer.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What scripts to follow? Being okay with making mistakes is perhaps, you know, one way to go about it. Yeah, I appreciate what you said about the way Goffman uses all these examples. And it pertains to, you know, one of the things I noticed reading this book, it makes you really reflect on yourself. I don't know if you had the same thing, but, you know, how do I do this? How do I see others do this? And, you know, I was reading this book while I was on vacation, you know, had a conversation with my dad actually about the tourism sector and how that is also a stage and what is the real life and what is theatrical. But one thing that I was bothered by in this book is the position Goffman takes as an author, because he creates a whole argument about how the way we interact with the world shapes the social world around us. And so it's a whole argument about agency, that we have an impact on the world around us. And that's actually a very positive one. But in his book, he is Mr. Know-it-all, and I'm going to tell you how the world works. And this is the way it works. It's written in this book, but he doesn't reflect on himself. And that's what I missed in the book. He doesn't reflect on himself, that he is also not perfect and not Mr. Know-it-all, how he encounters these things, but also not about how he came to his insights and how the way he was being a man, being in a particular place in the world, shaped the way he acted, shaped the way people interacted with him. And then, for instance, thinking about the example of the crafters in the hotel, and where he describes the backstage dynamics when the personnel of the hotel went for lunch. And then I was thinking, like, you know, as a social scientist, one of the key ethics principles is that you don't hurt the people that you study. You don't. And then I was like, well, the way he wrote it up, you know, he was kind of the voyeur. He was, you know, seeing it all and writing it up and telling the secrets. And I did feel like, could this book be written again in the time we live now? And if yes, how?
I'm going to go ahead and say, I think I understand why what you're saying it. I think it's a bit of an unfair criticism, though, because again, we're reading these books and we're contextualizing them, and we're seeing them as expressions of the time in which they were written. So I think for the time in which it was written, it's really insightful and self-critical. I do think, I remember that I really like his speech for the American Sociological Association when he was a president, that is published after, where I think, if I remember correctly, the way even he starts his speech is kind of by making fun of himself as being a performer in that situation and being kind of really self-aware of what his role is and how he might be performing that role well or not. And I think you do see that develop in him eventually. I think this was, you know, his first book where he's sketching a lot of these important ideas. And I think a book with the same theoretical kind of framework and concepts would still be really useful and really relevant today. I think, of course, the examples that you use and perhaps the degree of self-reflection that you would put into the book would be different, but that's, you know, to be fair, that's also because it would be according to the time in which it's been written, right? So nowadays we kind of demand to see a little bit more of the author and to, you know, if the author is writing about the construction of the self, then we want to see the author really engaging with the construction of the self. But I think that's what we value and what we expect now. Again, to Gavma's point, that's the definition of the situation now. It's not how the situation used to be defined before, what we expected from sociologists or authors, you know, even the idea of how you treat what your informants say and how you write about it has changed and has evolved, you know, throughout the years, mostly by having horrible experiences and things done that we have deemed to be not ethical. And so now we've changed our practice and we have redefined the rules of the game. And so anybody playing that game should adhere to those rules. But I think for the time that it was written, I think it's a really kind of wonderful book. And I think something that we missed, going back to our discussion earlier of, you know, how we might lessen the burden of having to represent or be really conscious and careful about how we present ourselves and how we perform both in the front and the backstage. He does give in chapter 6 some idea of like these protective, I think he calls it protective practices or defensive practices that actors do, but also the audiences do. And I think the audiences one are pretty interesting for the contemporary examples that we're thinking about now. He talks about this idea of the audience voluntarily staying away from the backstage to kind of show some respect. So I think I like that, because if we translate it to, you know, modern language and talk to the contemporary examples that we're giving, it's about, you know, respecting people's rights to privacy and to not always sustain a certain kind of performance, and that it's okay to sometimes mess up. And the other practices that he notices that audiences do as well to protect the performance is, you know, tactfully not seeing a slip or letting it go, you know, especially when we know that the performer is a beginner, or sometimes even, you know, colluding with the performers, you know, to help them out to kind of maintain the performance even when they've created some bigger mistakes. And, you know, this idea of the audience frequently showing extra consideration, which I really like, that I think we can also take into the examples we've been discussing that are more about our contemporary world.
I do want to respond. Sam, fair point. A book is also a front stage. So there's also a government behind the book. I do want to make one additional argument, and that is, as when I was doing my PhD, I did an ethnography in a Japanese multinational, you know, young woman. I already started this research when I was doing my master's, and the whole study was 4 years. And my PhD supervisor forced me to write a reflection as part of my method section on how my findings were influenced that I studied not only a different organizational context, even though part of the company was in the Netherlands, but also the fact that I was a woman and that I was young. So the fact that I was odd in many, many ways compared to the people I studied, I had to justify how my findings stood up. And I do find that, you know, if you write a book about how the way we are and we present ourselves influences the way society unfolds around us, there should be some reflexivity around how we do that ourselves. And why does a man, a white man, not have to justify that in a book and a woman does? I don't say it has to be like that. I think it should not. I think we should accept that when we study social reality, it's a construction, and we all experience it differently, that the book also makes an argument for. But I do feel that in terms of the rules of science by which we are judged, and that's not only for women and men, but I think also for people of color or studying non-Western companies or societies, you know, we should have equal rules about the level of reflexivity that we require, and also the person that evaluates to think about, like, what is my norm? Because it shouldn't be that we take male Western society as a norm and everybody and every context that's different needs to be justified. Yeah.
You're preaching to the choir. I totally, totally agree with that. And I'm glad that now we have developed those good practices.
Yeah, and it harkens back to the episode Sam, you and I did with Pedro on epistemic coloniality. It's right along that same vein. This is a really good and important conversation to have, because I think that this is a barrier to reading the classics sometimes, precisely because of this. Because I contrast this with Guldner, who wrote around the same time, and Guldner was a much more reflexive. And I think we have seen variance across authors as far as to what extent in those days that reflexivity was invoked. But it's very clear that the tendency was less rather than more. And now we understand that it's very important. We should not let that be a barrier. Now what we've seen with the rather rich conversation that has happened since, and also because Goffman himself reflected and brought it into his later work, it is a good thing to think about. We also have to consider that we ought not overdo it. It's something that can be overdone. It can interfere with the validity or the strength of what one finds. And I won't name authors, but there are some authors we've covered in this podcast whose other works I've read. And I thought that, you know, now we're trying to get too reflexive. We're trying to invoke too much of ourselves into the work, and we're not looking at sufficiently objectively. And a work I have in mind is written by somebody who wrote about, say, the current political climate within the United States, and was clearly taking a side, even though the author was supposed to be an objective social scientist. Reflexivity is important, but it should be a tool, not an end to itself. And that's a fine line to draw sometimes, I think.
Yeah, and I think, I think this, you know, this is supported, this whole conversation is supported by what Goffman is arguing in the book, right? This idea of self-representation and the theory of the self, and, you know, understanding all the complexity that goes into how we represent ourselves, even, you know, in our academic texts that are about research about other people, but we also have to put ourselves in there, and kind of all the things that can go wrong and all the things that we need to keep an eye on. So yeah, I think it's a discussion that is still super relevant when we're talking about this book.
So I'd like to follow on in a different direction. One thing that I think is relevant, I think I touched on a little bit, but we can explore a little bit more, is the extent to which we are seeing somewhat of a clapback towards the pre-pandemic era. And I'm going to give you an example of what I'm thinking about. This happened last night. My son is a drummer in a marching band, and we had our Halloween parade. My part of the country where I live right now, it's a big deal. Everybody turns out for this thing. The pandemic, of course, killed it rather significantly. The first couple times in which, you know, post-pandemic, we tried to reinstate it, it was very painful because participation was very light. Participants, both in terms of who was in the audience to watch and how many marchers there were, you know, how many different things there were floating down, was significantly reduced. It has grown back such that last night, I think we had more people there than were there before the pandemic. What this sort of made me reflect about is, for the past years with social media, etc., we have been seeing increased isolation or discussions about increased isolation among people and less of a social fabric. And in some ways, I think that some of the things that Goffman has been pointing out in terms of how we interact, we're probably starting to see that, you know, the direction we had been going for some time is just not really working. And we need to kind of go back to the way the things were beforehand to rebuild social fabric, etc. And yet at the same time, there's a lot about that old social fabric, as we've highlighted in the book. Some of the things that we dislike about the examples used are also part of the reason why we started to tear apart that social fabric and create something new. And as we clap back to the old ways, we don't want some of that bad stuff to come back. Is there something in Goffman to help us think about a way to go forward without going back?
Yeah, those are very important things you're mentioning here, Solomon. Thanks for sharing that. And I cannot answer your question, but I can add an additional element to it. And that is building upon what Sam said about idealization and the ideal. And this comes pretty close to young girls committing suicide because of, you know, the way social media works. I think that's a particularly vulnerable group. But when the way we interact is through social media, we interact through a stage where there are highly idealized images of how you should look like, how you should behave, cleaned up, all the filters we use and the editing that's being applied, creating unrealistic conditions for people to be, almost, and for a lot of people to feel insufficient to the extent that they give up in what way or in one way or another. A way you might be withdrawing and just locking yourself up in your house, but some people even committing suicide. What is the key difference between a real interaction? Well, at least there's no filter in between, and you see the other people are also imperfect and making mistakes, and it's okay to make a mistake. And it's also okay to be imperfect or to not always have the fanciest clothes, the best brand clothing. It's, you see other people wear sweatpants too. Yeah, we should not forget that thinking about like the different spaces there are. What is digital is not necessarily the same space as the offline. And the standards of being is not necessarily the same. And I think what is happening with the digitization and perhaps that exponentially transformed during the pandemic, where we didn't have the offline interactions anymore, is thinking that the standards that we see and as academics and as adults, we can reflect upon it. But when you're a young teenager, impurity and thinking about, you know, who am I? That's very threatening. That's very anxiety inducing.
Yeah, it's a really great question that you posed, Tom. And I think, as much as I love this book and I've been kind of defending it, I don't think in this book we find answers to your question. But I do think that we kind of find them in how symbolic interactionism and then related theories like inhabited institutionalism have developed, right? So this idea of there are, you know, kind of government stops at acknowledging that there might be, and he says this in the conclusion, there might be situations where, you know, social interactions come at an embarrassing and confusing halt. The situation ceases to be defined. Previous positions are no longer tenable. And participants find themselves without a chartered course of action. And so I think what we see now with studies, you know, both in symbolic interactionism and inhabited institutionalism, is what people do in those situations, right? And even when, you know, there's kind of a discrepancy between, you know, what locally makes sense to them and what externally is kind of being imposed, this new order, and how they are able to kind of take elements of that and then also recombine them through interaction again with meanings that are more suitable to the local conditions that they're facing. And I have a couple of papers that actually try and study how people do this in very different settings. But I think there I would see some, you know, in terms of theory, I would see some hope into, yes, if we take what Goffman is saying at heart, people have the ability through their performance and through interactions with others to redefine the situation, which he doesn't necessarily look into. He's looking more into how people sustain a certain definition of the situation. But, you know, we as people, we bring in experiences and values and things from other roles that we've played or other experiences that we've had. And so are the people that we're interacting with. And so I think through that kind of collective action, social interaction, organized work, we can come to kind of redefine how we should be doing certain practices, right? So I think that's where I see a little bit of a potential answer to your very difficult question.
Yeah, and believe me, I wouldn't have asked the question if I had an answer either. One thing I was thinking about is to what extent do we establish our performances as a villain vice as a protagonist? Part of the discourse and how divisive the discourse has become between disparate views. You clearly have actors whose performances are solely oriented on being on the attack, which is to say they practically exist to attack either the opposing side or the opposing side supporters. In a heavily polarized environment, it may be difficult for moderate voices to find room on the stage. Underlining my question is, where does one best go to try to break down barriers between people who are ideologically different? Is it in the front stage or is it in the backstage? Al Goffman's book can inform ways of valuing and changing the situation to be more conciliatory, or, you know, to change it away from being an us-them style conversation would seem to be what we would want.
Yeah. I think a lot of the people that work with these kinds of peace negotiation and kind of getting people from very different camps together, and this is something actually that we discuss at the CAPS Summer School, which we have an episode also coming up, or it's already out. It's creating common ground, right? So I think this can be done. I don't know if the front and backstage distinction matters as much as of how you get it going. I think definitely seeing more of this in the front stage would be very important for the rest of society. But it's about, again, creating common meanings, right? So these techniques of getting people to identify things that they have in common, kind of ignoring the huge elephant in the room, and then building some kind of common understanding from there so that then they can get to discussing, you know, what the conflict's actually about. I think that usually tends to have some pretty good or at least interesting results. But I think we need to be doing more of that.
Yeah, so maybe it's more in terms of finding people willing to fill that role of the integrator or the instigator to try to bring out those.
Which,
yeah,
Goffman calls a discrepant role, which is the bit that I never quite loved this idea of discrepant role. I do think it's easier to do this perhaps on the backstage. I think the idea of the front stage sometimes gets in the way of these efforts because there's this pressure to, you know, perform a certain role, again, to be somebody that, you know, knows their mind and knows what they think and is not going to kind of concede to the other side or whatever. I think, yeah. So I think it might be something that is done easier on the backstage and the front stage. Not that it should be that way.
Yeah, perhaps it's also how social media exponentially gives attention to opinionated views that are markedly different. Where this thought comes from is that I was thinking about nonviolent communication, and as I was listening to what you guys were saying, and how, yeah, a lot of communication, or the way communication is edited and broadcasted through media channels, is more opinionated. I wouldn't say it's violent communication, but definitely you could label some like that. But what is edited out? That's my question. And I felt like perhaps we need to edit it back in.
Yeah, thanks for that, Greta. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, so Goffman's book, like so many, you know, it's kind of capturing what is, and I guess we're sort of coming around to what should be. How do we get to what should be? What would be a vision? Because, you know, obviously, even in the ideal situation, it's hard to imagine one where the way in which we interact doesn't change. It's a matter of then to what extent the communication itself, the content of the communication, is constructive versus divisive. And that's that's not what he's talking about, but it's certainly one thing that we have in the back of our minds trying to think practically of where we would take this sort of a framework and actually think about applying it, or if not, or at least understanding it enough so that we could apply something to help build bridges or whatever it is we think needs to happen. Obviously, for that purpose, this book doesn't stand alone, but it certainly plays a very, very good foundation, a tool that allows us to understand so that we could do something.
Yeah, I think my final reflection is I really love this book. I read it 10 years ago when I was doing my master's, and back then I remember how it really kind of stuck with me, and throughout these last 10 years of like different situations and being kind of really aware of, you know, how much effort we put into sustaining certain common understandings when we're doing things together. And I still teach it today to my students. And I think just the language, you know, the problem that government presents, this idea of there's all this uncertainty, and Greta talked about this before, there's all this uncertainty in the world. And so one of the ways in which we narrow that uncertainty is by having some sort of common meanings, definitions, roles, scripts, right? Things in which we're expected, how, you know, things that tell us how we're expected to behave and what we can expect from others. The reason why I really love this book is because it shows you just how difficult it is to go, and, you know, everything that can go wrong and what happens when that goes wrong. And that's the reason why this, you know, this book is important for anybody that's interested in the study of organizations and of all types of organizations. And of course, there's a lot of updating that we need to do ourselves. You know, I teach it in Mexico, so I use a lot of examples that will be familiar to my Mexican students, and it's really easy to do, right? Like once you kind of read and reread kind of government's framework and language and concepts, it's really easy to think of your own examples. And so, yeah, I think it's a really valuable tool, not only for research, but even also for, you know, how we come into other organizations and how we're able to make sense what is going on and, you know, what can go wrong and why does it go wrong and why do we feel awkward in certain situations and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm a big fan.
Thanks, Sam. And I think I'm a fan as well. even though my opinion is going both ways, I think we discussed both the, you know, the affordances of the framework as well as its limitations. And I think what the book does offer you is a tool, a framework to reflect upon society and to reflect upon organizations, which are micro societies in their own right. I think I come back to what I mentioned in the beginning and the word scripts, because my key reflection is that my takeaway is really to think about the scripts that we're following and the scripts we want to follow and how we shouldn't hesitate to be creative there.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.